that is judged at the time to be the best reading. And it does have a few variations from the Dead Sea Scrolls, so there were a few variations even in the Hebrew text. When we come to Greek texts or Jewish Greek texts, there are far more variations, largely because these letters and documents circulated all throughout different parts of the Roman Empire and were copied many times, and it was not as organized a process, in a sense. So when you have a Greek New Testament text, it has been edited from hundreds or thousands of different manuscripts that exist from earlier times. Now, what are these manuscripts themselves? So let's just review. When you open a Bible, you're getting a translation of a compilation from manuscripts. Or you might, in many cases also today, you're getting, they work with a basic text, but they also consider other manuscripts that didn't find their way into that compilation. So they're hybrid ways of doing it. But just to simplify, let's say a translation comes from a text in the original language that was compiled by someone from a variety of manuscripts, sometimes hundreds of manuscripts. Where do those manuscripts come from? Well, those manuscripts were copied by people at different points in history. They are not the originals either. The originals we don't have. You know, the actual letter that Paul wrote to the Galatians, we don't have. We have copies of that letter that were circulated among people and passed around. And those copies are very close to each other, but they contain some variations. Sometimes it's a letter, sometimes it's a word. Sometimes, as you can see, if you read a modern English version, sometimes there are certain sentences that are in some manuscripts, but not in other manuscripts, like in John. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, we do not have a perfect text in that sense. And people make their judgments based on what they think should go into the text and what shouldn't. And the judgments that are made at that academic level of compiling the Greek original to be translated are these types of questions that you find discussed in chapter 10. So should it be Christian or should it be Christian? Those are the kinds of things they would deliberate over. And then they would decide which they think is more likely. And then the translator would decide how to translate that. Any questions about that process? Because it's very important to understand that sort of textual and manuscript reality.
So that's why when you look in Mark, it sometimes says verses, you know, or 6 through 16 or something, were not found in the oldest text or something.
Right. And it's also why you'll see footnotes sometimes, especially in New American Standard, which tries to be more conscientious about these types of things, saying that in certain other manuscripts, there's a different reading. So they, even when they pick the one that they think is right, sometimes they tell you that there are other readings because they're not completely sure. Now, one of the places that you can go to look at these different variants is a book noted on page 140 by Bruce Metzger, Textual Commentary on the Greek New Testament. And actually, I think there's now a revised version, the second edition, but it's the same title, I think. And I'm not 100% sure. I should have looked this up maybe, but if I remember correctly, this was compiled in the process of creating the NIV translation. And so it basically lists many of the different variants among manuscripts and how they decided to resolve those differences. So if you're interested, you can look. And what my father has mentioned here is that for Matthew, the 28 chapters of Matthew, this commentary gives about 200 places where there are differences in the manuscripts. Okay.
Wow.
For the 28 chapters of Acts, there are 600 places. Sometimes the differences are only a single letter, sometimes a single word. So, in other words, there's a lot of study and deliberation that has to go into trying to figure out what the original text itself was. Because we don't have the original text, let alone the translations. And for many of these issues, it really just comes down to a judgment call. There's no way to know for sure. Short of God revealing it to you, you know? So when you read something, you're also getting the result of that process of manuscript interpretation. And the common way of designating different manuscripts is by different letters, often Greek letters, sometimes Hebrew letters, or sometimes with regard to the place in which they were found or are located currently or something like that. So one of the most famous texts of the Hebrew Bible is the Leningrad Codex, because it's held in a library in St. Petersburg. It's now St. Petersburg.
Didn't that come from Sinai? Santa Caterina, I think.
What's that?
They brought it from, a monastery in Santa Caterina. The Russians, they brought it to Lenin. I think that's the story behind it.
Maybe. I'm not sure. Somehow I thought maybe it came from the Karaites. But you might be right.
Maybe.
You might be right. I'm not sure.
Isn't it really, really old?
Yes, it's one of the oldest complete texts. That's why it's very important. But as you can see, we're not really sure where it drives up. But you can easily look this up, though.
Kmart.
Nowadays, you can look up any of this stuff on the internet.
Yeah,
so just type Leningrad Codex into Google, and you'll find it.
Presto. Yeah.
all right. But so here you have to distinguish the manuscripts in some way. So they're given different names, sometimes by letter, sometimes by place. So here we have Codex Aleph, Codex Bezai, and so forth. All right. If that's clear, we can go into some of the actual evidence, I think, that is given in the chapter for understanding what the word actually is. Now, again, keep in mind that there are only three places where this word appears. It's not like this is a common thing in the scriptures. It's not nearly, it's 100 times less common than disciples. 100 times, okay?
Yeah.
But let's read these three places. Would someone like to read Acts 11:26?
Is it quoted in here?
Mm-hmm. It is quoted in here, but it's on page 137. No. The second to last paragraph. Why doesn't someone read that entire short paragraph? The first verse is,
the disciples were called Christians first at Antioch. The disciples in Antioch did not call themselves that. God did not call them that. They were called that by other people in Antioch.
Okay, the second verse is, someone else?
26:28.
This is the last paragraph of page 137.
Then Agrippa said to Paul, you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian?
Okay, and can you read that?
Sorry.
That's Acts 6:28, and then?
Paul did not call himself or anyone else by that name. Agrippa did.
Right. What did Paul call himself?
A Jew.
Yeah.
Sometimes he called himself a Pharisee. In these same places in Acts, by the way, when he was on trial. Okay, someone for the first paragraph of page 138.
The third verse is, let none of you suffer as a murderer or thief or evildoer, but if as a Christian, let him not be ashamed and let him glorify God in this respect. Can I go on?
Sure.
The followers of Yeshua were being made to suffer under a particular name. They were being arrested and imprisoned under this particular name. They were put to death under this particular name. This name is not given as a name by which they were calling themselves, but as a name under which they were forced to suffer. This will become clear as we examine the history of the text and the historical events in which it points.
Okay, so just by looking at those three verses in translation, the translations that do say Christian, in fact, we can see that it's not something that the disciples called themselves, which is interesting. So if we want to imitate their behavior, we might want to consider what we call ourselves as well. Now, just to move on a little bit to get towards the evidence, this was already mentioned, but on page 139, the issue centers on one simple Greek letter, an eta, rather than an iota. This is, to be sure, a small item, but one of great significance. The correct determination of this name is critically important to the existence of the whole Christian system. After all, it would make a significant difference if the Bible does not refer to Christians at all.
Didn't the Jews play on Antiochus Epiphanes' name?
Yeah.
Instead of Epiphanes, you know, somebody who made himself God,
right.
Like madman. There's a word in Greek that sounds almost identical to Epiphanes. I don't remember what it is. Like Antiochus and madman.
Epimenes.
Yeah, that's it. So this is sort of like
that's
the
a good
same
point.
Sort of animal.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a little bit different in that it might not have even been a conscious thing, though, at first. Like, the way it's presented in most sources is that the general Greek-speaking population didn't have any clue what they were talking about when they talked about Christos. So they made it something that they could understand. Christianoi, yes.
It seems like, I mean, I might be reading a lot into this thing that I looked up the dictionary and what you just were talking about. It seems like they're just, making a big joke out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Choosing wordplay.
Right.
To call somebody what they're not.
Yeah. I think these are good points. I mean, I don't know exactly what they were doing at the time, of course. But they certainly might have been doing any of these things. Wordplay, making fun of them in some way, or could just have been pure ignorance. Not understanding. But regardless, we can see in the evidence that there's a distinction between Christianoi and Christianoi.
I think it's very weak to call it mere ignorance.
We're looking from our perspective today. I mean, if you look from the perspective of people at the time in the Roman Empire, it might not seem so strange. But we don't really have to settle that question. It's not essential to the argument here. The basic argument is that the text should be read as Christianoi rather than as Christianoi. In other words, it should be Christians and not Christians. So that's the only argument, really. And then there are four subpoints that include the evidence for this argument. First of all, unchanged manuscripts have Christian, not Christian. And we already read one quotation which describes that. And then on pages 139 and 140, you have a bit of an explanation of that, how later scribes copying these texts thought, well, that must be a mistake, Christian, so we have to change it to Christian, because that had become the practice by that time in the 4th century. But that doesn't mean that it was the original, and it seems likely that the original is found as often in what people consider more reliable texts, which have Christian. And so an objection is raised at the end of that section on page 140, but wouldn't God have protected the text?
Well, apparently not.
Why do you say that?
Because of all the differences.
Right. That's the, it's not a dogmatic answer. It's just saying, well, we have different texts. Which one did he protect? You know? it's just, let's look at it straightforwardly. Now, I think that God does protect his word in certain respects, but he did not. The argument that's made here is that God does not prevent scribes or translators from making errors. And I think that's clear from the previous chapters. He does not prevent theologians or preachers from distorting the text, which I think we can all testify to. He does not prevent individuals or groups from misrepresenting him and his word. And in fact, all of us do this to some extent, don't we?
No.
We wish we didn't, hopefully. But unless we were perfect, you can speak for yourself, but but you would have to be perfectly like God in order not to misrepresent him in any way. So God does not prevent those things from happening, and it has something to do with God's character, which has to do with giving people choice.
Free will.
By the way, God takes this to a very extreme level. Mm-hmm. He didn't prevent the Holocaust, you know? Mm-hmm. That's something about God's nature. So,
the Inquisition.
Right.
That was done by Christians.
Mm-hmm. Right. So he obviously didn't protect the integrity of the people who were claiming to represent him and his word. He lets people choose, even if they are bringing damage to his name.
Seems too permissive to me.
Talk to him about it. Okay, so regardless of your philosophical approach to those questions, in a good way, the practical issue is that we have different texts. So we have to, in a practical sense, try to make judgments of which are better. And I think also, you know, there should be more transparency. I fully agree with and laud the decision of the New American Standard translators to give alternate renditions, and they should probably give more of them. Mm-hmm. And all the other translators should give them too. And they should explain some of these complications of translation much more than they do. Mm-hmm. Okay, the second point, which produces evidence for this claim that it should be Christian and not Christian. Second century historical sources use Christian. And here I think is almost an even stronger argument that's almost conclusive, because you need to have it in a few of the manuscripts to really make a good case to say that, look, these most reliable manuscripts actually have Christian. But now what we see in point number two is that all sorts of other texts also have Christian in the early period, and that it's in the later period that those texts get corrected, so to speak, corrected to Christian. Okay. So this is almost conclusive, I would say. Mm-hmm. And there are certain examples on page 140. The Jews constantly made disturbance at the instigation of Crestus, so he expelled them from Rome. Later in the 5th century, so the original text says Crestus, a 5th century Christian historian changed the text when he quoted Suetonius. Orosius wrote as follows: Claudius expelled from Rome the Jews constantly rioting at the instigation of Christus. So you see the difference between the 2nd and the 5th century. The 2nd century text says Christus, and in the 5th century they said, well, that must be Christus. So we can see that this process actually did occur. It's not speculation to say that this process might have occurred. The process did occur. And then, you know, there's this commentary saying that nonetheless, this work became the standard history work, standard reference work. People believed what it said because it was written, but it contained errors because it had been corrected. You know, we don't have to judge these people. We're not error-free ourselves, of course, right? But it still is a change, and it still is what happened.
Well, I was always told that Christians came from the word Christos, where they were called the followers of the Christ.
Right.
And it was a derogatory term to have been a follower, so they called him Christos or Christians.
But this does not support that.
This doesn't support that.
Well, the translation little Christ. That's mm-hmm. what I was taught. Yeah. Christians means little Christ.
Well, see, we're talking about two different things. I mean, if the word Christian itself is related to Christ and does have something of that meaning, mm-hmm. little Christ, or, you know, maybe followers of Christ.
Oh,
yes.
So that's what they changed it to.
But that's what it was changed to. The point that's being made here is it was a different word originally, Christian.
But the reason it was a different word was because Christos was an unfamiliar term mm-hmm. to the people of that time, mm-hmm. and Christus apparently was a common name, so they just sort of used the common name rather than the unusual name.
If that were true, then the premise of this chapter would be disproved already, because they were at least trying to use that term.
I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding. These are good questions. Let me explain this a little bit, and then see if those questions remain. Okay, and then I'll try to address them. The point that's being made in the chapter is that there are two different words here. Okay, Christian and Christian, if we're going to give English transliterations. Right, these are mm-hmm. transliterations, they're not translations.
Okay.
If we were to translate Christian, what would we translate it as?
Wasn't it a name?
Followers of Christos.
Okay, maybe followers of Christos. Something like that.
But why would it have to be that? Why couldn't it be something like your Cretan?
It could be. Or something else, let's say. Or something else. We don't really know. All we know is that there's a difference in the manuscripts. This seems to be the most likely explanation.
because we can see it in other texts with Christos. What about Christian? If we were to translate this from Greek of the time, instead of transliterating, how would we translate it? Keep anointed. In mind what we've learned so far.
Anointed.
Spirit ones.
Okay, yeah, yes, spirits. Exactly. It has a totally different meaning.
Right.
It sounds the same to us in English, but it has a totally different meaning. Little smeared ones, yeah. Or yeah.
Little grubby urchins.
Yeah. Okay. So it's like it's not a homonym because it's not the same sound, but it's like a homonym in English, where you have two words that sound the same but have different meanings,
yeah,
and maybe spelled differently. So the fact that they look close in English is confusing the issue a little bit. Does that make sense?
Right.
Well, the ending. T-I-A-N, where does that come from in a literal source?
Well, it's just the shortening of the Latin.
It's making it smaller.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it has to do with English etymology, how English suffixes are formed, you know, deriving a lot of them derived from Greek and Latin.
In the Greek, it would have been like Christianos.
Right, Christiana. Yes. So this is an anglicized transliteration.
Okay.
It's not a pure transliteration.
Right.
Okay.
So the argument then that's made is that this was not a term that was used by the followers of Yeshua to describe themselves. They did not call themselves little Christs or little smeared ones or anything like that. And it was also not a term that was used by the broader population to refer to them. Instead, what the broader population used was this term, Christian, which apparently referred to some problematic name in their society. Okay? Remember, again, that Christos was a name. Christos was not a name in Greek or in Jewish Greek. Christos was an adjective that meant that something had been covered with oil. And in Jewish Greek, it came to be the equivalent of Mashiach. Mm-hmm. So there is actually a big difference in meaning between these two things.
It'd be sort of like the difference between a Lennonite and a Lennonite, you know, like...
Yes, with O-N yeah. or I-N.
Yeah,
yes. Exactly. That's a very good point. Yeah. I mean, it's not exactly parallel because both of those are names. But yeah, that's an excellent illustration. Okay. I think we were on the second point, that the historical sources also say Christianos. You have another example towards the bottom of page 141, whom the crowd called Christianos. But the later texts corrected it. So again, corrected in quotes, because they were actually not correcting, they were corrupting. But they thought they were correcting, so they corrupted it, to Christianos. And this is one of the advantages of modern scholarship, in that we can go back and find a lot of earlier manuscripts and compare what happened. So we can see things like this happening, whereas throughout the Middle Ages and even the early modern period, people didn't necessarily have access to this type of information. So later scribes changed the text of Tacitus from Christianos to Christianos because they knew that Christianos was correct, because that was the practice of their day. Christianos didn't make any sense in their day. So we can see again that these changes are taking place. And then here's a really nice quotation from Tertullian, the end of the second century. But Christian, so far as the meaning of the word is concerned, is derived from anointing. So Christian is derived from anointing. Yes, and even when it is wrongly pronounced by you, Christianus, for you do not even know accurately the name you hate, it comes from sweetness and benignity. And then there's an explanation later that Christos in Greek has that meaning. And that's why there's a name, Christos.
And it was only by one letter that they're spelled differently in Greek?
Apparently.
Yeah.
And are those letters... Yeah, at all similar to each other?
Well, they look like... They're described here. It's the Eta. And the Iota. So they don't really look similar. It wouldn't have been a confusion like
in Hebrew, Dalet and Resh are sometimes confused.
Right.
But it wouldn't have been that. It would have been more a decision that this was a mistake or had to be corrected.
There you have it. We're really Christians.
So, well, no. But if you were to be insulted by people of the ancient Roman Empire, they might call you Christians.
And I was insulted.
That's, then, Peter refers to that in what he wrote, right?
Mm-hmm.
He says, if as a Christian, let him not be ashamed.
Right.
So that implies that the name had a derogatory meaning.
Right, yeah. Ashamed, I think so.
Meaning.
Right, that people would naturally be ashamed, in other words. Mm-hmm. So he's saying, don't be ashamed.
Yeah.
That's a good point. But here, again, you have a clear witness of a text saying that the general population was not understanding what Christos meant. And they were not calling the believers Christians. They were calling them something else. Now there's some other evidence in here too, like talking about how Christian scribes sometimes went a little further to make their point. A Byzantine forger even fabricated the apostolic decree ordering the name of the followers of Christ to be changed from Galileans to Christians. So in other words, they understood that Christians was not the original name that believers were called. That's at the bottom of page 142. And then just on the at the end of this section 2, the top of page 143, second paragraph, the conservative theologians and editors of the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia concluded that Christian was probably the actual designation, as it appears in the uncorrected manuscripts. Later manuscripts were corrected, i.e. changed, to read Christian. The editors do not even suggest that there were two different manuscript traditions. The reason is that the historical and linguistic evidence for Christian is compelling. In other words, sometimes when you have variations, the commentators will say, well, there were two different manuscript traditions, and group A has this reading, and group B simultaneously has the other reading. But here they're not even saying that. They're saying that earlier it was Christian, most likely, and then it was just changed. Okay, point 3 under the evidence for this argument that it should be Christian. Christian, though it was an erroneous designation, was probably the original designation. And we've dealt with this to some extent already, and it's related to points A and B, or 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you some more explanation of how it may have arisen, how it was used legally to accuse them, and so forth. We're getting a little short on time, so I'm going to just go to point 4 unless anyone has any specific questions or comments on that. Okay. Number 4 on page 144, the Christians did not call themselves Christians. They called themselves disciples. And so we've dealt with this a little bit also already. Disciples appear almost 300 times from Matthew through Revelation. The Hebrew is Talmid, the Greek is Mathetes, and our word disciple comes from the Latin discipulus. Discipulus.
Aren't there other sources outside of the Brit HaChadashah, the New Covenant, that says that they called themselves Evionim? Or?
Well, that is a theory. I don't think there are sources that actually say that. As far as I know, there's evidence for the existence of the Ebionites, or I guess in Hebrew, Ebionim, that many people think were what we call Messianic Jews. In other words, Jewish believers in Yeshua. I don't think that there's a text as specific as what you were describing.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that would have to be looked into.
Well, I was just wondering how they got that, you know.
But the Ebionites, even if they were Messianic Jews or Jewish believers in Yeshua, they were probably not all of the Jewish believers in Yeshua, but a specific community.
Localized, like in Galilee or around Judea.
Okay, right, maybe, yes. And if you look at most Jewish history books, they'll say that the Jewish believers in Yeshua were called Nazarenes. Notrim. And that makes some sense. Yeshua was called Yeshua HaNotri. Yeshua of Nazareth, the Nazarene. So his followers were called Nazarenes, and it's related to what you can think of with regard to other prophets. Eliyahu HaGiladi, Eliyahu HaTishbi. You know, Elijah is referred to by his place and his clan, and Yeshua as well. So that makes some sense, and there's some reason to believe that even with regard to just looking at contemporary Hebrew practice. What is Christians today in Hebrew?
Notzrim.
Notzrim. That's the word that came to mean Christians. So it seems like they may have been called Nazarenes. But in any event, that's not in the scriptures either.
Right, it's not.
In the scriptures, we don't have them calling themselves any single name, which becomes an important point a little bit later in this chapter. And I won't hold you in suspense. I'll just mention that the argument, I think, that's being presented is that what God's interested in is not something that can be reduced to a label. God's interested in circumcision of what he calls circumcision of the heart. Mm-hmm. He's interested in people behaving appropriately, giving him honor, being humble. These are not things that can be reduced to a label. Because you can adopt a label and not do any of those things. So what God is after is something different. So the word Talmid, the disciple, expresses it better because it implies someone who is studying, who is learning to be better, who is approaching what his teacher can do. And of course, Yeshua said, one is your teacher. You know, so it implies a type of progression towards a goal that has some content rather than just a label. And maybe a label that designates, you know, this community as opposed to that community. It's more related to what's going on inside you and in your actions. So, in this section 4, we've already seen the basic point that the disciples did not call themselves Christians, even if you think that the text should be Christian. It wasn't something the disciples called themselves. But we think it should be Christian, apparently. And they didn't call themselves that either, as there would have been no reason for them to call themselves that. In the first place, Christian is what biblically ignorant people called the disciples. It is not what the disciples called themselves, nor how they identified them, nor how God identified them. Christian is what historically ignorant scribes then changed the text to be. Mm-hmm. Now, the objection that some people might make is that we know today what a Christian is, and that's what they were, what we mean when we say Christian now. Well, I don't think that's true for any number of reasons. There's a great gap between modern Christianity and the Jewish believers of the first century in culture, in life, in ideas, in practice. There's a huge gulf. So they were not what we mean today by a Christian. And then secondly, as it said here, there's no fixed definition of what a Christian is. It means many different things to many different people. There was an illustration here of the Italian guy speaking in Italy about being a Christian. What was the problem he ran into?
They're saying believer. They're translating as believer.
Right. Everyone is a Christian in Italy. I mean, what are you talking about? You can't tell people to become Christians. It doesn't make any sense. So that just shows that his understanding of what a Christian is was different from theirs. Mm-hmm. There are many different definitions of what a Christian is. And most people who say, well, we know what a Christian is today, or I know what a Christian is today, have a definition that is different from the definition that most people have for Christian. So at the end of the chapter, actually, he says on page 146, you know, Christian may communicate one thing to you that you find to be positive and so forth, but there are 6 billion people in this world. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter only what the word means to you. You can't just make the word mean whatever you want it to mean. There are 6 billion people. The word has meaning to all those people. There's a historical record of more than 1,800 years. There's a behavior and faith of 1 billion people who call themselves Christians today. So you can't just set aside all those things and say, well, Christian means this to me. Mm-hmm. Maybe it does, but that's not what it means to billions of other people. So that's important. One should consider what one is communicating with one's words. And I think on page 145, there's another clear analogy that's made to sort of drive home this point, which is, again, utilizing the Muslim case, which we've done a few times in this class already. Why is this instructive? Well, in the Islamic view, reading on, in the third full paragraph on 145, Adam was a Muslim. So were Abraham, Moses, David, Solomon, and Elijah. Jesus was a Muslim too.
They all had turbans, huh?
They were all submitted to God. They were all Muslims. So is it a problem if we call them Muslims?
Yeah.
Why? That's what the term means, submitted to God, right?
It means to somebody.
They're not Arab.
You don't have to be Arab to be Muslim.
The Arabs are Christian.
They're Arabs that are Christian, and there are non-Arabs who are Muslim.
Thank you.
They're not the descendants of Ishmael.
You don't have to be a descendant of Ishmael to be Muslim.
Thing, sorry.
It's okay. It's okay.
They're not practices. They did not practice Islam.
But what Islam means is just submission to God.
Or surrender to God.
Surrender to God, yeah.
But God.
Well, there's only one God.
They don't believe it.
They don't follow the moon God.
But they were before Muhammad.
That's right. They could never have been Muslim in the...
No, but they were part of the progression, just like you believe that Moses and David and Yeshua were all part of the same progression. You know, Yeshua said, Abraham saw my day and was glad.
This is sort of like the argument of last week. I can't remember the specifics, but as though you're calling. I'm not thinking the words that I need to use. But simply because Muslims may be submitted to God doesn't mean that other people are not submitted to God.
Who's a
okay
definition?
All right, there's a start saying that the definition that I'm giving of Muslim as being submitted to God is not strict enough, because there could be many ways of being submitted to God that don't include Islam. So. But the point is that, right, the point is, right, no, but the point is that a Muslim could legitimately say that is the definition of a Muslim. That is what I've been taught a Muslim is, that is what I believe a Muslim is, that is the definition of a Muslim. But that's not a sufficient definition for what almost everyone in the world thinks of as a Muslim or Islam. Mm-hmm. There are certain other things that go along with being a Muslim that do not apply to everyone that is submitted to God, as you were saying, that do not apply to, at least in a non-Muslim view, do not apply to Adam, Abraham, Moses, David, Solomon, Elijah, and Jesus. But they could say, look, that's what it means to me. They were Muslims. And that's the same thing that's happening here with Christian. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different thing. But they're saying, well, that's what the word means to me, so I'm going to call these people Christians, and I'm going to call myself a Christian. But it doesn't come from the text. I mean, you can call yourself anything you want, but don't say it comes from the Bible. That's all. Now, there's a point that's made from this analogy, which I think is important, which is, why not speak and think of them as what they were? Instead of making up all these other things and trying to explain them, why not just let them be who they were and who they said they were?
Mm-hmm. Not sure who they
were. Who did Yeshua claim to be?
Messiah.
The Messiah, the King of the Jews. Who did Paul claim to be?
A Jew.
Why not just let them be who they said they were? Especially if you believe they were speaking truth.
That grants them power that you may not wish them to have, perhaps.
But isn't it the same kind of power you would want accorded to every person?
Not if you're the one who wants to be in power.
Over others. Yeah. Or over a tradition.
You want to be treated equal, only a little better.
Okay, yes. Right.
Animal farm.
Right. That's true. There are all these complicating factors.
But if you call him, call Paul a Pharisee, and you call him of the tribe of Benjamin, then you have to understand what a Pharisee is.
Yes.
And what a Benjaminite person, how does that relate to him?
Why did Paul call himself a Pharisee?
Well, he was trained to be a Pharisee under Gamaliel.
Right, so he was trained in that way. He was part of the Pharisees. He was integrated into that system.
I'm telling you, Jews, give us an idea of what that meant.
Also, in the context of his day, there was a fundamental conflict between Pharisees and Sadducees. The Pharisees believed in resurrection of dead, and in the afterlife, and in the supernatural, and the Sadducees essentially denied all those things.
It wasn't a bad thing to be a Pharisee back then.
Well,
until you miss the Messiah.
Yeah. Well, there were Pharisees and there were Pharisees. And Republicans and Democrats.
Right. There are good Republicans and bad Republicans, good Democrats and bad Democrats. Is that what you mean? But whether or not that's true, Paul, in that specific instance, was identifying himself with those who believe in the resurrection of the dead, which was a fundamental conflict in that Jewish society. Some believed in it, they were primarily associated with the name of Pharisee, and some didn't. So it made sense for him to identify himself that way. Later, Pharisee might have come to mean something else. But again, if you impose something else on these people that they don't say, you're creating a different world. You are saying something that actually isn't in the text. And it obviously affects how you view yourself as well. Most people who say they believe the Bible in the world today call themselves Christians. Mm-hmm. That's a non-biblical thing to do.
Little do they know.
Little do they know, most of them, yes. Yeah. Most of them think it's a biblical thing to do.
It's not bad being called little smeared ones.
Well, that's not what the word Christian means in common parlance today.
It will when I get done with it.
All right, good. Let me just finish up here with a few of the comments on the last page of the chapter, and then a couple additional points. Maybe any final questions or comments that you have. Page 146, we cannot control what others call us. Yeshua couldn't control what others called him. But the word Christian communicates an indistinct faith system and an indistinct behavioral system. In other words, something that's not well-defined. It could be almost anything. You know, there are Christians who gave their lives to save Jews, and there were Christians who gave their lives to kill as many Jews as possible. You know, there were Christians who devoted themselves to prayer and seeking God, and there were Christians who killed those who sought to be close to God. You know, so I mean, it could mean almost anything. It's an indistinct system historically and in terms of faith.
But disciples is too.
Yes, but it's not a label. It's a description of a process, of a position that you're placing yourself in. There are Talmidim who are not Talmidim of Yeshua. But if you call yourself a Talmid of Yeshua, it says you're trying to become like your master, like Yeshua. Mm-hmm. You're learning from him. Mm-hmm. So it's a descriptive word. It's not a label in that sense.
Fundamentalist is kind of on both of those. I've had that from personal experience. My mother was talking about something, accusing this guy of being a fundamentalist since he was doing it, but meaning derogatory, and I said, well, depends on what, you know, we have different views of what that word means.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's right. Label nowadays. I mean, you could be a fundamentalist Muslim, or you fundamentalist this or that, but you, of course, in this country, you still mostly think, oh,
right.
There's
good. Yeah.
But that's just simply means someone who has the fundamentals of something down.
Yeah.
So whether the fundamentals of faith or the fundamentals of car mechanics or the fundamentalists.
Well, it could mean a lot of different things. I mean, yeah, Islamic fundamentalists, you know, yeah, could mean all sorts of different things. But you can't prevent people from calling you a fundamentalist or a Christian or whatever if that's what they want to call you. But you can think of yourself and call yourself whatever you feel is right. And that's the point here. The word Christian, so communicates something indistinct. It also communicates a system that is often anti-Jewish and almost always centered outside of God's relationship with Israel. In that sense, it is anti-biblical and does not smell like a rose. It communicates a large historical package that is rather unpleasant. It often invokes a Christos who is not the Messiah. That may not be what it communicates to you, but there are 6 billion people in this world. There is a historical record of more than 1,800 years. There's the behavior and faith of 1 billion people who call themselves Christians today. So in other words, all of that, the ideas that the 6 billion people in the world have of what a Christian is, the history of 1,800 years of Christianity, and the behavior of all the billion people who call themselves Christians today, all of that goes into the meaning of the word Christian. You can't just put that aside. In the last paragraph, the scriptures do not give any particular name for the followers of Messiah. His followers cannot be identified by a particular name. They can be identified by a particular way of living, which is what Yeshua himself said. They will know you by
the love you have for one another.
The name Christianoi, they will know you by the name Christianoi, they will know you by the name Talmidim, they will know you by the name Nazarenes. Is that what he said?
No.
What did he say? They will know you by what?
Your love.
By the love you have for one another.
Yeah.
And there, you know, different people have made observations, of course, throughout the centuries on whether or not the people who call themselves Christians, followers of Jesus, have been known by that. So you can't tell the followers of Yeshua by the name Christian. You can tell them by the love they have for one another. It's interesting. You may be emotionally attached to the name Christian, but it is not a name that God gave. It is more important that you be attached to Messiah himself. And in that, it is more important that you be attached to the Jewish people, which relates to the last chapter.
You should be attached.
Now, we have only 1 minute left. I wanted to make one final remark. And I think this is more relevant for Gentile believers, because Jewish believers can call themselves Jews. But what do Gentile believers, who have often called themselves Christians, what do they call themselves? What do you call yourself?
We were having a long discussion about that the other day, because I used to be very proud of being a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned that all these other people that were calling themselves Christians really had nothing to do with what I believed in. And so then I started calling myself a believer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met some believers that really...
Well, you never
be perfect. And Muslims called themselves believers,
right,
too.
Yeah. So I decided that there's really a big distinction between a Christian and a believer and a follower of Yeshua.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's no perfect answer, because any word can be misappropriated,
right,
and used by people for bad purposes. I might call myself a Messianic Jew, but doesn't mean that I necessarily agree with everything that every Messianic Jew stands for or does or whatever.
Yeah.
Or everything that I do or stand for. That's another story. But
right. So when people ask me now, especially if they come in the house and they see some of the Judaica and everything, and people ask me now, I say that I'm a follower of Yeshua.
Right.
He worships in a Messianic style, Messianic church.
And that's nice. And I mean, I think that each person should give some attention to thinking about this and what words they think are best to express who they really are and not just what the common term is. And I'll give you a couple examples of that. I'm not going to give an answer of what people should call themselves, but just a few things that other people have come up with. This is from that great source of knowledge, Facebook. Facebook.
Facebook?
You know, the online social community,
it's like
of friends.
And all that.
So I have some friends on Facebook, and some of them are Messianic believers. And one of the options on Facebook is to list your religion. So you can list, you know, whether you're single or in a relationship. You can list whether you're interested in men or women. You
or
can
both.
List. Yeah. And you can also list your religion. Okay.
How many choices did they give you?
Well, you can write whatever you want.
Oh,
that's cool.
So here are some interesting answers that I've seen with some friends. First from a Messianic Jew, where it asks for religion, a statement from that part of Jacob where it says, true religion is this, to visit widows and orphans in their distress and to keep oneself unspotted from the world.
Yeah.
That's a good answer to a question of what you're...
That,
right. But, well, maybe someone could come up with an acronym. But actually, an acronym would defeat the purpose. Because the whole point is that it's not a name that God is after. It's not a label. I mean, he will give us names, he says. Names that have actual meaning that are appropriate to each person. But the point is that he's not after some sort of label to slap on people. That, unfortunately, that's how organized religion, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, etc., has often viewed it.
Yeah.
Just get as many people as you can into the fold and slap those labels on them, and it doesn't really matter how they behave or what they believe, really.
Well, you only have 12 spaces on a government form.
Right, okay, that's just one example. Another Messianic Jew that I know on Facebook put religion as very common in some ways, not so common in others. I think that's a pretty good answer. I mean, because anyone who's really interested, but you can't tell someone in a label what you believe. If someone is really interested, it's more than a label. It's a whole way of living and a whole understanding of what life is about. And that can't be summed up in just a label. And then here's one from a Gentile believer. So I really admire this. The answer that he gave was grafted into Israel's olive tree, Romans 11.
Wow.
So that's a quite different answer to the question of what is your religion. Doesn't make a lot of sense to most people.
Right.
But if they're at all interested, they will ask. And then they will actually understand something instead of just having a little box. And can you imagine if all Christians in the world today, instead of calling themselves Christians, and sorry, if all Gentile believers in God, in the God
well,
of Israel, instead of calling themselves Christians, call themselves people grafted into Israel's olive tree and really thought of themselves that way, we would be living on a different planet. Yes?
One thought that just occurred to me is that with the use of labels, it seems that people can just live and go about on autopilot. They don't have to really consciously think about what they're saying
right.
they represent. And people usually like shorter labels rather than longer ones because it's easy to say, it's quickly said, quickly forgotten, and you don't have to really try and think, what is it you're saying? Because other people will fill in the gaps for you, whether or not they fill it in the way you want them to. So I guess perhaps that's an even better reason why in Scripture it says that Messiah said that we will not be known by a name, but by our love for one another, because if we just had a name, people wouldn't really take the time to understand it.
Right. And you also wouldn't be able to tell, you know, who really is seeking to follow Yeshua and who isn't. I mean, he says, by their fruits you will know them in another place, right? What are the fruits of God, of
love,
God's
patience,
spirit?
Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control.
Okay, so that's how you can identify followers of Yeshua.
Against such there is no Torah.
Amen.
Well, I know when I was trying to shed witness on my car tag, you know, my one car says, for Yeshua. And when I was getting the other one, I wanted to have something to do with Messianic Judaism, but all I could come up with in the seven letters was Messy Jew, and I thought...
It's pretty good.
That would have offended somebody, so we went with four out of nine instead, but I'm still working on that Messy Jew one.
Leslie's uncle calls her that.
I was thinking about the word follower, you know, in the name of
little smeared ones.
Jacob's name in Hebrew is Yaakov, and it means he will follow.
Mm-hmm.
And he got that name from following Esau, grabbing onto his heel. But we don't want to follow Esau.
Good point. Well, I think we probably have to end now, but I hope this has been helpful. And again, to me, one of the main points that comes out of it, in addition to, you know, this word or that word, is that God isn't after, you know, just calling ourselves by a certain label. He's after something deeper. The way I read the Bible from beginning to end, he's after a right heart, right mind, right actions. And he's willing to work with us to help us develop those things, to help us get there, because part of his word is showing us that we don't have those things, a large part. That's why Torah was given to a large extent, to show us that we're not perfect. We're not right in our thinking. We're not right in our motives. We're not right in our actions. But God is willing to take imperfect people and ultimately transform them into his image. And that's something much greater than slapping some label on someone and saying, aha, now you're in the right path. Now, if you want to look a little bit more deeply at some of the material from the chapter, I'd suggest that you read also the footnotes. There were a lot of footnotes, and they contain additional information.
One very long footnote.
One of them was pretty long, maybe two of them.
Over a page.
And then next time, we'll be dealing
with... What are you doing on Sunday?
What are you doing on Sunday?